news.
Quiet, please.
Ladies and gentlemen.
You ready for the big show?
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one fat ass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I'm aware that what I'm about to say is going to sound completely lunatic. So bear with me and just take that warning in advance. Does it make any sense when a women's sports club decides to kick women out of the grandstands who've bought a ticket and paid to be there to watch the match because they're wearing clothing that supports women's sports? As I said, I know that sounds crazy, but that is the day and age that we're in right now. And it's once again putting this issue right in front of everybody. It happened at a sports match this past weekend. It happened at Providence Park in Portland. It happened where there's a match going on between two women's sports clubs. And the women who showed up were simply wearing clothing that promoted XX and XY. And it said messages like save women's sports and women. It just said women. And the women's sports club had them kicked out of the grandstand because of that. And then it got even worse. Let me tell you how that happened in just a moment. First, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in a moment at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, and we may get some naysayers on this program for more than 30 years have always gone to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you can vote in our X poll. The X poll question can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Glad to have you with me. But let me tell you what happened in this case, because this shows you how completely insane sexual politics have become in America, and not because of conservatives, but exclusively because of the lunatic left in the United States. So what happened? A spokesperson for the Portland Thorns soccer club, right? They announced that 8 fans had been removed from the sports venue. That's Providence Park. Why? On the 6th, 2 days ago, Saturday, they were removed because they were wearing some clothing. XXXY Athletics Apparel. We'll get to that in just a moment with a message from the woman who actually started that company. And she started it in support of women's sports. But apparently there are people who do not appreciate real women's sports. What they appreciate is they appreciate it if you stay in your political lane. So Amy Souza, who was part of that group, is quoted as saying, "We didn't distribute any materials. We came armed with copies of our own code of conduct, and we followed it to the letter." And yet they got kicked out anyway. And then, well, then they went down the road to another kind of notorious place. It's called the Sports Bra. Now, the Sports Bra is an innovation that came about in Portland. I mean, where else would something like that start? That is largely aimed at watching women's sports for women's audiences. But apparently they've got some big name sponsors who plan to take it national. They have the money behind it, and they're going to try to make this franchise work everywhere. The problem is, they're only in favor of women who don't disagree with them about the subject of trans. And what are trans? Well, trans, conveniently, are not women. They're biological males who pretend that they are women, who assert that they are women, who identify as women. So what happened at the sports bar? The same group that had been kicked out of Providence Park showed up at the sports bar, ordered up some food and drink, and then a server came over and kicked them out. Take a listen. I know it's a little hard to hear, but I want you to hear the exchange between the server in the sports bra and the women who had come there to watch soccer and to take part in women's sports and support women's sports.
There are people that are in here that are uncomfortable with those shirts, and so I'm asking y'all to leave. If I have to call authorities to get y'all removed, I will, but I don't want to do that.
We don't have to do that.
No, what I...
just asking if you would please consider the depth of...
And I have to send most of our clients and they
Why did you know those clients?
I didn't realize it until someone... I don't look at people's shirts whenever you come in.
There's nothing wrong with these shirts. What is
there's nothing wrong with our shirts is what they're objecting. They're saying, look, we came into your place of business. We ordered up food. We ordered up drink. You brought us those things, and now you're kicking us out? The women were kicked out of the sports bar, which is specifically a women's sports bar, because they were wearing clothing that supports women's sports and rejects the idea that women in sports should be forced to compete with biological men, which is exactly the message that the woman behind the creation of all that clothing, the XXXY clothing, her name is Jennifer Say, and this is the way she sizes up what she calls unfair competition.
To get to that level and then be thrown into totally unfair circumstances of having to compete against a biological male, it's hard for people to understand how devastating that would be.
Imagine that. That's Jennifer Say, the woman who started an entire clothing line because she got tired of hearing, you know, that women were going to be forced to compete against biological males. And I'm tired of it, too, because all you have to do is take a look at the numbers. I am not, and anybody who listens to this show on a regular basis will say, Lars is not at all an expert on any aspect of sports. But when it comes to this, sports and politics and sexual politics in particular, you know what I can say? I can say that biological males can outdo biological females. Is that a slight on women? It is not. It is simply saying that when it comes to running or jumping or lifting or any of the other things, for the most part, that are involved in sports, that men are going to do it better, faster, and everything else than women. Why is that? I mean, I've used as an example, men broke the 4-minute mile back in the 1950s. Women have still not been able to run a 4-minute mile. They may be getting closer, but after 75 years, they still have not hit that mark, whereas the men have continued to get faster. Does that mean men are better? No. It just merely means that when it comes to that kind of competition, men can run faster than women. And Jennifer Say understands that. You know who doesn't understand that? The women behind women's sports like the Portland Thorns. So, for example, the Rose City Riveters, which is the official fan account of the Thorns Football Club, that's the women's soccer team in Portland, has released a statement in which they celebrate the removal of women from the game on Saturday. They said, like the Antifa takeover of men's Portland soccer team, the club is an extremist political group that advocates for anti-American and anti-science positions. Antifa and extremists recruit from the club and use the sports games to spread their propaganda. So, something that's very, very popular for women turns out to be misused and abused by people who have a political agenda. And for example, the sports bra, the woman behind that, and I would love to talk to her, I'd love to interview Jenny Nguyen. She says, we are all about being inclusive. That is, as long as you agree with the trans community. The minute you don't agree, you got a problem. It's Tuesday. It's the Radio Northwest Network. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. If you're losing it and...
If you don't want to talk but want to be heard, email Lars at talk@larslarson.com. He actually will read it. Now, here's Lars Larson.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right, you know you got a right to sit.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
Pumped by River City Environmental, that great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
Hey, could any conservative hope for a better way to send a message about the failed leadership of the state of Oregon than this week's Freeway Armageddon beginning on Friday? Not a chance. And the burden falls the hardest on the most liberal voting bloc in Oregon, and that would be Multnomah County voters. Southbound lanes of I-5 will shut down entirely at the Moda Center on Friday, and they're going to stay closed for 5 long weeks. ODOT, the hated multi-billion dollar state agency, predicts that some folks are going to see their travel times double or even triple. And I'm not suggesting the repairs are not necessary at the Moda Center, but if elected leaders of the state, all of them Democrats, had not severely and deliberately undersized both freeways and even surface streets for decades, the closure would not hurt nearly as much. But if the pain has to come, let it come to the Democrat Party's stronghold of Portlandia. When the legislature tried to slam the entire state with billions in new taxes to fund ODOT, voters statewide rejected it 83% to 17%. And if you said, but Lars, what did they do in Multnomah County? They rejected the new taxes 70% to 30%. A little bit softer rejection, but not much. Voters told ODOT to live within its means, a message that Governor Kotek and ODOT and the Party of Slavery have turned a deaf ear to. They just merely turn around and say, okay, if you don't want those taxes, what kind of taxes will you let us increase? Give them a wake-up call when your ballots show up just over a month from now. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Our poll on X today: should New Mexico be renamed New America? President Trump spent much of Sunday night sharing apparently AI-generated images and memes on Truth Social, including one suggesting that New Mexico should be renamed New America, and another one declaring the moon is ours. Among the posts was a mock-up of New Mexico's state map with the word Mexico crossed out and replaced with America. I'm not sure that the liberals understand that Trump is, for the most part, just trying to troll them, but apparently he's doing a fantastic job of it, and they can't tell the difference. Our question of the day, brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's actually causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. So, Chuck writes in from Longview, Washington. Lars, happy Labor Day. I'm curious to know how many times Marie Glusenkamp-Perez, member of Congress, has appeared on your show. I'm going to answer that first. Zero. She's been invited. She has never agreed to do it. But Chuck goes on. As you're aware, far-left Democrats have concerns about her support for Republican bills. Some even say she's an undercover Republican because of her votes. She's been compared to Senator Fetterman of Pennsylvania due to her votes. I don't think she's nearly that good. I don't recall hearing Glusenkamp-Perez on your show. I do remember when former U.S. Representative Brian Baird appeared on your show. In fact, you were gracious enough to allow me to address Baird on your show regarding the 2007 U.S. military surge in Iraq, and Baird was closer to Republican points of view than Glusenkamp-Perez. Do you see Glusenkamp-Perez as being to the left of Baird and Fetterman? Do you think the far-left Democrat Party is expecting too much? Here's what I think is going on with Marie Glusenkamp-Perez. Number one, she's a phony. She's a phony about her background, that it's a blue-collar background. She's a phony about a lot of things. But here's what's really happening. She realizes that she is in a congressional district that is just as close to 50-50 as they ever come. It's very close to being half conservative, half liberal. That means she has to at least make a nod in the direction of supporting a few conservative causes. If she does not, the voters will replace her, which is exactly what I hope is going to happen when the election rolls around in November. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Presented by Oregon City Garage Door.
On the basis of a brand new poll, I'm going to suggest that the Daily Grill go to all 12 members of the Portland City Council. I realize this new government, it came into existence about 18 months ago. Prior to that, it had been a 5-member council that made bad decisions. Now it's a 12-member council that makes even worse decisions and does not really represent the public. But having said that, consider the results of a brand new poll. Portlanders are feeling iffy about their new government. A survey released this week shows that only 22% of Portland voters believe the city's government is effective. 22%. and almost 40% do not. Now, one of the people who answered that poll, I feel like there's no strategic plan in place. A lot of programs seem to be reactive rather than visionary in addressing what Portlanders want. The poll comes a year and a half after Portland overhauled its form of government. The voter-approved change tripled the size of the city council. Not quite. It went from 5 to 12. And introduced geographic districts as a way for voters to feel better represented by their elected officials. According to the poll, voters are feeling less represented by their city council compared to last year. When asked if there is currently somebody on the council who represents them, 31% said yes. That is down 10% since just last year. And my favorite post on social media from Brandy Cruz, and I consider Brandy a very good reporter. She said, keep in mind how many billions of dollars in taxpayer money have been spent to save the salmon, only to have billions of our dollars kill the fish. Only the government is that incompetent. The world's first light rail line over a floating bridge that's in Seattle is inadvertently, accidentally killing fish in Lake Washington. And now Sound Transit is scrambling to try to find a solution. It's unclear how many fish have died, but apparently the number is in the thousands. Thousands of fish. And why? Because they grounded the electric light rail system on a cathode into the lake. And apparently that grounding is now taking the lives of a bunch of fish. So what do you do when your multi-million dollar choo-choo train starts killing endangered fish? Well, maybe you have to shut the whole thing down. We only know that whatever the solution is, because it's government doing it, it's going to cost a lot. Your calls are welcome at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, and weather. Interviews, podcasts, local and national news. Get it all at LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show on a Tuesday after Labor Day. If you want to jump into what we always call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. If you happen to be a naysayer, and we love naysayers on the program, don't get me wrong. We invented that idea over 30 years ago. Naysayers always go to the head of the line, and they always will. And we've never broken from that. The only time I have allowed that if we already had, say, the president of the United States on the phone and we got a naysayer call, I might take the president's call first and I'd have to take the naysayer call second. But naysayers go to the head of the line. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And our poll on X, should New Mexico be renamed New America? I would say, yeah, go ahead. Name it New America. Donald Trump seems to be on an American naming binge at this point. He amplified his image by writing in a separate post that many people have suggested changing the name of New Mexico, describing New America as much more prestigious and beautiful for that state. The New Mexico Post touches on a long-running political theme for Trump, rebranding geographic landmarks and places, and there's certainly nothing wrong with that. You can find the poll on X at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. And last week's poll on First Amendment Friday, we asked you this. Should a parent have the right to take their own child to church? Now, I have to give you a little explanation on that, not as thorough as we did last week. But here's what happened. Mom and dad, in this case, are getting divorced. They have disagreements about how child custody is to be shared. Mom wants to take her daughter to a church of her choosing. Dad says he doesn't want the daughter taken to the church at all because he says the church has dangerous ideas. And I actually don't remember, but it was seemed like a conventional Protestant Christian church. So does the dad have a grief, have an objection or a reasonable objection? I would say he does not. But should the mom be able to say, I'm going to take my daughter to the church of my choosing, dad can do the same or not at all. Now, on that note, I want to talk about nuclear power just a little bit, because I've been looking forward to this. James Walker is going to join us here in just a minute. Mr. Walker, welcome to the program on the for the first time. Thank you so much for taking the time today.
No problem at all. No, please. Please be on.
So tell me about this. The NRC has just added a fast track for nuclear power. Does that mean we could start to get reactors and power generating stations built more quickly? Whereas in under the old school approach to nuclear power, it routinely took decades to get through the licensing and the building of these things. Can we change that? Ms. Walker?
Can you hear me?
Yeah, no, I can now. Yeah.
Great, great, excellent. So you are right. The intention with this NRC regulation is that the previous way they were licensing reactors was very set up around those traditional big light water reactor systems, the huge ones.
Yep.
And and that affected any sort of a different type of reactor system that wanted to be licensed, whether it's advanced reactors, Gen 4 reactors, that kind of thing. So the NRC is looking to put new frameworks in place to allow for licensing of new reactor types, so you don't get stuck into that big safety evaluation that might be more applicable to big reactor systems. And a lot of that stuff is just not applicable to these smaller systems that are being developed now, which can be built much, much faster. And need far fewer safety systems because the fuel, for as an example, might just be more inherently safe. And it gives you an ability to ensure that the fuel itself gives you an ability to ensure that the reactor cannot break down in the same way a conventional reactor can. So that means that we will hopefully now get an NRC that's able to license reactors of a different kind faster than how they would have conventionally been licensed before. So all that to add up to, yes, this should overall lead to an expedited route to get these new advanced reactors out into the market commercially.
I'll tell you, Mr. Walker, by the way, James Walker is a nuclear physicist. Should I be calling you Dr. Walker at this point?
Yep, that's right.
Fair enough. CEO of Nano Nuclear Energy. I've always been a defender of nuclear power, except I had to admit the old school way of doing it was every reactor was a one-off, you know, and they built it and it was its own unique animal. And the next time they built one, they built it and it would be different, which meant, if I'm correct, and correct me if I'm wrong, that you couldn't get any lessons learned out of building one because the next one was going to be different anyway, which means you couldn't really add to your knowledge about how the reactor should be designed. Is that a fair way of summing it up?
Oh, look, that's incredibly accurate. And what this led to as well was that the cost overruns, time delays of these big reactor projects, they became very normal. And I think Vogtle in the U.S. at the moment, I think that's on track to be the most expensive reactor ever built. And it's mostly because those lessons learned from all the building of reactors before just didn't carry through. Now, if you compare that as an example with China, they're building two large gigawatt-sized scale nuclear power stations every single year, but they're just moving the crew from one project to the next, to the next, to the next, and they're keeping those lessons learned and not changing that plant. Now, that's a good strategy. You can't really do that in the U.S. And so it's even private industry that have been the drivers behind these small modular reactor systems, because it's industry solution. Like, how are we going to get around this problem of lessons learned and carrying on knowledge? Well, the solution is a modular system where you can manufacture the components remotely and then just ship them to site. And that way you can continuously manufacture components. You can stockpile them. And when you get the demand or the order, you just ship those parts to site and then you assemble them. That gets you around that lessons, those lost lessons learned from each project, and you just copy and paste that reactor system and deploy it in new locations. It's a really wonderful response, and it also gives you an expedited timeline from order to first production of power.
And in fact, does it also solve part of the financial problem? Because if you can plug in these modules and do it a bit at a time, you can get cash coming in to help finance the rest of the construction instead of you only get a dollar in when the entire plant starts working.
Oh, look, that's a big one. Like, at the moment, I would say if you're looking at a big gigawatt scale light water reactor system, you could be looking at from once all the approvals go through, maybe 15 years. Maybe you're looking at 15 years' time to get that first big-scale reactor producing power. Now, that means that it's all capex without any revenue coming in to mitigate against that big liability. Some of these reactor systems, because especially the smaller, much more modular ones, you could get a timeline between 3 or 4 years from order to first output of power, especially if all of the components are already manufactured.
Absolutely. Mr. Walker, we'll look forward to having him back. That's James Walker, Dr. Walker, a nuclear physicist and CEO of Nano Nuclear Energy. Dr. Walker, we appreciate your time. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Coming up, every Seattle school student now eats free of charge. I think that's a real problem, and I'll tell you why. Coming up next on the Radio Northwest Network. You know, when your water heater...
If you're surrounded by Northwest liberals...
I cannot stand these morons any longer. If you don't come with me this instant, I shall run amok.
Come to the place where common sense prevails. The Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails. It's a Tuesday after Labor Day weekend. And I'm glad to get those calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. We started off with the bizarre notion that only in a place like Portlandia could you get a women's soccer team that decides to kick a group of women out of the grandstand at Portland Providence Park, which is a city government-owned facility, but kick them out because they were wearing shirts that displayed the message "Save Women's Sports," also said "women" on the shorts, on the shirts, and it also displayed the XXXY. Now, this is part of an athletic brand that is aimed at saving women's sports from the intrusion of so-called transgender women, meaning biological men who imagine themselves to be women. So you have a women's sports team kicking women out of a park for supporting women's sports. And if that wasn't bizarre enough, then they go down the street, same group of women, and they go to a place called the Sports Bra, which is a women's sports, I guess, club. Not a club. You don't have to be a member, but you go there to watch sports on television and drink beer and things like that. Well, it primarily aims at women. I mean, obviously, from the name, the Sports Bra. And there are plans to take that whole franchise national at some point. And what does the women's sports bra do? They kick the women out because of the shirts they're wearing. Well, I got this interesting question from Tom Persons, who wrote in by email, talk@LarsLarson.com. And he said, Lars, remember Sweet Cakes? And I do. The lawsuit for forcing shop owners to go against their beliefs. How is it now that sports bra can do the same? And Tom, I think you're onto something. I suspect that in these giant pile of rules and regulations that have been passed by Portland City Hall, that there are rules in there that say you cannot discriminate against somebody because of their beliefs. Now, that may or may not apply in this case, but I have a feeling the people who got kicked out, the women who got kicked out of the Sports Bra, also got kicked out of Providence Park, all because here's a team, the Portland Thorns, that say we're all about inclusion, except they only mean they're all about inclusion as long as you don't have a different position than they do on biological males who consider themselves to be women because they identify as women, and that in that case, they're not inclusive at all. They're not tolerant at all. And the same thing applies to Jenny Nguyen. That's N-G-G-Y-E-N, Jenny Nguyen, who apparently owns the Sports Bra and started the business as well. I mean, she ought to be ashamed of herself. And if you say, well, that's not fair to say that about her unless you invite her on the show, Jenny Nguyen is invited to come on this show anytime she wants. I would give her all the time she ever desires to explain how it is that a business that caters in particular to women sports fans would kick a group of women sports fans out of the club because those women sports fans were wearing T-shirts supporting women in sports. How does that make any sense, Jenny Nguyen? Come on the show. Tell us why. Explain it. Because I don't think she's going to want to explain it, because it would require her to take a position that I'm sure the woke folks out there would not tolerate. They would not at all, as tolerant as they ever want to claim to be, they are not going to tolerate the idea that you would say, well, biological males competing against biological females is not legitimate. It's not fair. It's not legitimate. It should not be allowed. And now we're seeing much of the sporting world has begun to reject that entire idea. And then you've got what's going on in Seattle this last weekend. Seattle, not quite as bad as Chicago on an average weekend, but over Labor Day weekend, 7 people shot, 3 of them dead in a single weekend. I'm going to talk more about it later on today. Cameras could have helped the investigators. This is from the Seattle Police Officers Guild. More officers could help prevent the next tragedy. But when Mayor Katie Wilson continues to oppose proven public safety tools, Seattle pays the price. Katie, public safety requires accountability, staffing, and technology, not excuses. So, is Katie Wilson in favor of increasing the number of police officers in Seattle? She is not. Is she in favor of turning on the closed-circuit cameras, whether they're flock cameras or some other kind of camera that shoot pictures in public spaces? She's not in favor of that either. And I think part of the reason that she and the rest of her crew at Seattle City Hall have become so uncomfortable lately is that when they had that shooting that happened at the Bight of Seattle, so you have a public event and you have people who are hurt, people who are shot, and they get shot because apparently there was some gangbangers who showed up at the event and began firing shots at each other. Do they have pictures of the bad guys? They don't. Do they still have one of the shooters or the killers in that case running around loose? They do. And in fact, do you know the brand new term of art, and I've got to mention this, is that the acting Seattle police chief, because they got rid of their last police chief because of that incident involving the Bight, although I'm not sure that Sean Barnes should have taken the blame for that. But still in all, he's out. There's an interim chief in. Do you know what he now calls them? They don't even call them shooters anymore. There was enough wrong by calling people who end up putting a bullet in somebody a shooter. A shooter is somebody who simply shoots a gun. You can be a shooter if you go to the gun range and put holes in a paper target. But in the case of Seattle, they're now calling them trigger pullers. In other words, both the government and the media have done everything they can to separate the action of pulling the trigger and sending a bullet down the barrel of a gun, a bullet that then connects with flesh and does damage and in some cases kills. They're doing everything they possibly can to separate the bullet and the trigger puller from the action it actually causes. If you shoot somebody and they don't die, you're an attempted murderer accused. And if you shoot somebody and they do die, you're an accused murderer. But instead, City Hall Seattle, just like City Hall Portland, wants to call them shooters. And unfortunately, most of the media goes along with it, because the media ought to be calling them what they are. If you fire a shot and you hit somebody with that shot, and you're accused of a crime, then you are an attempted murderer. You're an accused. You are not just a shooter, and you're certainly not just a trigger puller. You're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
FM News 101.
15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Lars. This is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country,
and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get you your phone calls and emails. It's Tuesday after Labor Day weekend. I hope you all had a wonderful and safe Labor Day. But consider this. Drivers already know just how bad the traffic can get on Interstate 5. And a new bridge over the Columbia River between Oregon and Washington should, I say should, address that. It's not going to. Even the numbers put out by the IBR, the Interstate Bridge Replacement, suggest it's not going to change traffic congestion. If anything, it's only going to get worse. But in the short run, what you may not know is how bad the bridge is going to be during construction, and that's going to go on for years. So we've got Bob Ortblad, who joins me now. We've had him on before to talk about the IBR project. He has a master's in civil engineering and a lot of experience in this field. Bob, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
You wrote a letter to Clark County Today in which you suggested that during this project, people may or may not know this, but the IBR will be replaced by having first a southbound span of the river built, and then once that's built, they will take all the traffic from both north and southbound existing, the old bridges, and shift them over to that new span. But the span isn't very big. It's 76 feet across, and they're going to cram six lanes of traffic on there. What is that going to mean about the safe crossing speed for that bridge?
Well, that's their plan. There's a lot of compounding factors to that. I mean, even the final bridge will have a fairly tight S-curve, a minus 3% grade. But with when they cram all six lanes, there'll be almost no shoulders at all, which makes the bridge extremely dangerous. And I just took all those factors, and you know, we got AI now, and I cranked them, and I just asked the question. You know, with this tight S-curve, a minus 3% grade, very narrow shoulders, I said, the IBR has not explained how they're going to allocate the shoulders and the width planes, but I asked AI basically to come up with the safest allocation and then ask them with that allocation of space between shoulders and lanes to get, and then the frequent wind, ice, the lane width, shoulder, narrow shoulders, tell me the speed limits. And they came up with phenomenal, the top speed limit for cars should be about 30 miles an hour, and top speed limit for trucks about 20 miles per hour. This is on the temporary crossing with all, and when you have the permanent crossing, it doesn't really change too much, you just get wider shoulder lengths.
Okay, but the other thing is, Bob, it's 30 miles an hour for cars, 20 for trucks, assuming not much wind and no rain or ice. What happens when you throw in wind and other weather conditions?
Well, wind would reduce it by about another 5 miles an hour, from 20 to 25, from 20 to 15 for trucks. And if you put in ice or rain, basically you pretty much have to restrict the bridge for no trucks, and cars would have to basically crawl across the bridge. There's a lot of compounding factors. I put it all into AI. I say, let the IBR run their own analysis. I've asked them to do this, and they've basically sent an email to the safety engineers, Wilbur Washdot and ODOT, ask them to analyze it. I may be wrong, but please check me. I got an email back from the Carly Francis, the head of the interim director of the IBR, saying they've already been approved by the federal agencies, so we don't need to do any more safety checks.
But that means that Carly Francis, the interim administrator who took over after Greg Johnson left, I think kind of unexpectedly toward the end of the project, or the end of the design part of the project, she's saying we don't need to have our engineers do an independent analysis and determine the speed limits. She doesn't already have one, does she?
Well, they've got what something like 18,000 pages their EIS, but they really doesn't cover some of the issues I brought up, And so when they always cite their manuals and their EIS, but if you, the issues I brought up aren't covered there, so I asked them, why not have, there's each Washington and Oregon both have a PhDs with safety engineers. Why not have them do sort of an independent analysis? The IBR has their consultants, which really have a, what do you call it, conflict of interest to make keep sure this project keeps going. Let's have somebody that's a little bit independent. WSDOT's not quite that independent, neither is ODOT for that matter, but at least hopefully we have two professional engineers put their stamp on this thing saying it is safe. Hopefully they have enough professional integrity to do it right, and I may be totally wrong, but I'd like to see that.
Okay, so Bob, line this out for my audience. We're in 2026 now. They start construction next year, 2027, and then it takes them several years to build the southbound span. What happens then?
Well, after they get the southbound span, they're going to shut down the two existing bridges and divert all traffic, both north and south, to the one southbound bridge that will be 78 feet wide. And that'll be there for about 3 to 4 years at least, while they tear down the existing bridges and build the northbound span. So it's going to be a dangerous bridge for at least four, extremely dangerous bridge for at least 4 years. And even after it's finished, I kind of wonder how safe it'll be.
Well, in fact, do they have to have that S curve in there, and what's the purpose of that?
Well, basically, there's a slight S curve right now. That's really down on the ground as you approach it going south or going north either way. But basically they're moving the whole bridge down, about 200 or 300 feet downstream. But they have to line up with the existing freeway. And the only way to do that is to make that S curve a little more exaggerated. I just scaled off from their drawings. They don't have a final design. It's a design build thing, but you can pretty well scale off the distances. And they told you how long the elevated section is. It's about 1,500 feet. And
well, Bob, while we've got time, real quick question. Are they holding this back? Is Carly Francis refusing to do this because she realizes if she comes to the public and says there are going to be times you're going to be able to go across that bridge at 20 miles an hour, that she's going to get total rejection of the idea from people north and south?
I suspect there's been an awful lot of hype on this project, a lot of PR, but sort of more PR than engineering. I would like them to check my analysis. That's all I'm asking. Please do a safety analysis using.
That makes sense. Bob Ortblad is a master's in civil engineering, and he says the IBR's top truck speed might be 20 miles an hour or less. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Homicides in downtown Seattle next. Lot in dust.
Ah, taxes. What say you, Robin Hood?
So you think you're overtaxed?
Overtaxed, overworked, and paid off with a knife, a club, or a rope?
Why, you speak treason.
Fluently.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. So, 7 shootings, 3 homicides in downtown Seattle in less than 24 hours. Is City Hall's hands-off approach getting people killed in the Queen City? We'll get to that in just a moment. First, I want to get to your phone calls and emails. If you want to join the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Let me start with Neary. Hey, Neary, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi, Lars. I have a question.
Okay.
When Congress makes laws, do we get to pick and choose which laws we're following and which ones we're not?
If you're a Democrat, you believe that you get to pick which laws you follow and which laws you do not. But otherwise, no. Generally, no. You're not supposed to pick and choose. Why? What are you applying this to?
Okay. I think in Michigan, the city council has chosen to give illegal aliens the right to be police officers. I mean, in law enforcement, the people that enforce the law that Congress make, that we cannot pick and choose. Illegal aliens.
Okay, let me tell you where you didn't specify when you first asked me, does Congress make the laws? Congress makes the laws for the entire country, but the individual laws for the various states, 50 states, if you're a conservative, 58, if you're an Obama voter, those are made by the state legislatures of each state. And it may be happening in Michigan, too, but I believe the instance you're thinking of is the state of Connecticut, where they have, in a town called Danbury, they have voted to let non-citizen immigrants and DACA recipients who are illegal aliens serve as cops. Is that the one you're thinking of?
Yeah, I guess that's the one. But here's my question.
All right.
So where is the supremacy clause apply?
Well, it would apply if there were a federal law, and I don't believe there is one, but let's say if you had a law that said you may only serve as a police officer in the United States if you are a citizen of the United States. As far as I know, there's no law that says that. Are you aware of any law that says that?
No, I do not. I also, when I did my own little research, I kind of find out that illegal a police officer who acts illegally still can give you a lawful order.
If he is empowered by his city as a cop, you're right. He can give you a lawful order. I think what I find out of joint, Neary, is this. Danbury, Connecticut is allowing not just non-citizen immigrants, which could include green card holders, but they've also allowed DACA recipients. Well, you remember DACA? That was the illegal program that Obama created with a stroke of the pen.
Yeah.
And he did it. He did it a year after we had a soundbite we used to run all the time of Barack Obama telling a group of people who asked him, why don't you just make it legal for these illegal aliens to stay here? And he very carefully said, I don't have the power as the president of the United States to simply make something legal. That has to go through Congress. And a year later, he wrote up DACA, which is not a law. It's not a court decision. It's just something that said, we're not going to take any action on illegal aliens who came here as kids. Well, that still means they're illegal aliens. So Danbury, Connecticut is talking about allowing illegal aliens to serve as cops. Does it make any sense for somebody who's breaking the law to be enforcing the law?
That's my point.
Yep.
That's
You're
exactly
right.
My point. I was like, how can we actually take that seriously?
You can't. You can't. But then again, you know, would I be surprised if, say, Seattle or Portland decided to let DACAs become cops? I wouldn't be surprised at all by that. But the message that we're going to let people who are breaking the laws enforce the laws, I think that makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Any more sense than it makes to have Seattle reacting the way that it's reacting or not reacting to the murders of three people over the weekend and the shootings of seven. Let's go to Bill. Hey, Bill, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Illegal aliens cannot own firearms. There was one arrested, I think it was in Maine. He was acting as a police officer. And it's my understanding illegal aliens cannot own firearms.
Not only not own it, but there's another thing you ought to mention, Bill. You can't possess one either, because if you said, well, the city of Danbury, Connecticut will own the gun, but we will assign it to a police officer, a DACA is not allowed to possess a gun in the United States.
Right. That's exactly right. And they shouldn't. This has gotten totally out of hand.
Yep. I agree. And what do we do about that? Bill, I appreciate the phone call. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. And then consider this. You had three homicides in Seattle. One that happened about 12:30 in the morning. So just after midnight on Saturday night. Midnight, just after midnight on Sunday morning. You had another one at 2 a.m. and one around 11:45 p.m. Three people murdered, seven people shot. And here's what the interim police chief, Andre Sales, had to say.
You mentioned a proactive approach. Can you be specific about what's being done in these areas as far as maybe increasing patrols or working with business owners?
Yep. Working with business owners, increasing patrols, bike patrols, working with our community response group and our gun violence reduction unit as well, looking at ways to where we can identify individuals that are known, we call them trigger pullers in our community, identifying them, making sure that we put in cases on those individuals, working with King County Prosecutor's Office to bring these individuals to justice, because the families that lost loved ones throughout this year and years past deserve justice in this matter.
Yeah, they deserve justice. And here's the police chief of a major American city, the interim police chief, describing somebody who's fired a shot that hit a human being as a trigger puller. Not a shooter, not an assailant, not an attempted murderer or an accused murderer, but no. They are now a trigger puller. They're going to change the language, and they're going to try to use the language to pull the wool right over your eyes. And you're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network.
The Lars Larson Show. Portland's news, traffic, dropping a Portland truth bomb.
My favorite thing about living in Portland is no matter how many fentanyl overdoses happen, no matter how many tents get set up, you can't blame black people for that.
Back to Lars.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails in a moment. Billions of dollars in tariffs just hit on both sides of the border, both in the northern part of the United States and the southern part of Canada. We've got a real trade war going on. So who's going to pay the real price? Is it Washington or Ottawa? I thought we'd talk to Dan Dembski about that. CEO at Unbound Merino. Mr. Dembski, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me. Pleasure to be here.
So give me your view on all of this, because I've seen people who've defended the Donald Trump's actions with the tariffs and said, look, Canada isn't playing straight with the United States. And I've seen other people who said, you know, Trump's being unreasonable. You give my audience your point of view on this. Tell me what you think.
Well, I mean, I agree that some of the complaints or some defense of what Donald Trump's doing is legitimate. I think where I disagree is the remedy. I mean, I'm a Canadian business. I started my company here in Canada. And last year when the whole tariff thing started unraveling, especially with the elimination of de minimis, we were forced to go and expand our distribution in the United States. So we set up a company in the United States. We employ people in the United States. And while I was doing that, I was thinking, this might make sense. I think what Donald Trump's doing maybe makes sense because he owes us as a Canadian business nothing. But, you know, now we're going into the United States and creating jobs and all of that. So there's a part of me that thought I sort of understand what's happening here. But now I'm also operating as an American company. And it's my American business that's being hurt right now. So I think, you know, it's just a blanket targeting of all things coming in from Canada. And I think it just doesn't quite make sense as a legitimate response to whatever issues you have with how Canada is treating the United States.
Well, how about the issue, and this is just the one I would pay the most attention to, has Canada been used as a laundering place to launder some goods from China that are coming into the United States, things like steel and aluminum and materials like that, where they come through Canada and then they escape the kind of tariffs they'd be subject to if they were just coming directly from China? Is that a legitimate thing that we should object to?
I mean, is that a legitimate thing to object to? Absolutely, if it's true, right?
Yeah.
But I think that that should be investigated as its own thing. You know, I mean, if you're going to say there's an issue with steel coming in, you have concerns about that, you could tariff that and maybe put the onus on Canada to prove otherwise. But if you're going to put tariffs on hockey sticks and food and apparel, it has nothing to do with laundering some kind of trade from China, you know, steel imported from China and bringing to the United States. I mean, they're unrelated. So I think it's just, I agree that you need to solve a lot of things, and there's always going to be unfair situations in any kind of trade between countries. But I
what
think
do you think got us to this point then, Mr. Dembski?
I think Donald Trump has a way of negotiating that's unique, and I think it's aggressive in that it impacts businesses that have to completely change how they operate completely with something that can change on a weekly basis. I mean, it's really, really hard to keep up with. And, you know, right now I'm not as affected by what's happening with the tariffs. But if it comes to November, if there's no resolution, it's really, really going to impact all of my U.S. business. You know,
I'm talking to Dan Dembski. He's CEO at Unbound Merino. You're in the clothing business, right? Just tell my audience.
Correct.
I don't mind you giving your company a plug. You deserve at least that as a thank you.
Well, we're an e-commerce-only apparel brand. We're called Unbound Merino, and we have we sell on our website, unboundmerino.com. We ship all over the world. 80% of our customers are in the U.S., so we have to import into our U.S. entity, to our warehouse in Dallas, and we ship all over the country from there. And we import from all over the world. We make stuff in everywhere from Italy to all over Asia, China, Japan, Korea, and Vietnam. And we also make stuff in Canada. So, you know, in the past year and a half, depending on the week, there's an issue with stuff that's coming in from China or Vietnam, or it could be Europe, and now it's Canada. The thing that's weird about Canada to me is, as a Canadian, is I feel like we're getting in a fist fight with our older brother, and I'm just praying for mom and dad to say, cool it off, guys. Like, we're supposed to be friends. We love you guys. And I thought, and hey, I go to the States all the time. I think Americans, you know, you might pick on us, make fun of us a little bit because we're your smaller little brother, but we're friends. We're friends. We're supposed to be friends. And we make the best hockey sticks in the world. There's no doubt. If you're going to tariff our hockey sticks, you're going to get more expensive hockey sticks or buy lesser hockey sticks.
I have a feeling that's true. And in fact, I always give Canada credit because I love using your national healthcare system as an example of how we shouldn't go. Because I'll tell people, you know, if you could get free healthcare in Canada, why, if you had the money, would you travel all the way to the United States and pay for it here? And the only answer is because that system stinks. And unfortunately, people die while they're waiting in line to get the health care. And so it provides me a convenient example of this is what national health care would be, except if they bring it to, if, you know, Bernie Sanders and others bring it to the United States, there will be no other country we can flee to find decent health care.
Yeah, you know, I mean, there's an argument there for sure. But I, you know, that's how we do it, and you do the healthcare your own way, and that's what makes our countries different. But when it comes to trade, and we have real businesses that rely on the partnerships that we have across borders, and I think it's okay to change the rules and to say that things are going to be different. It's just hard to stomach it when the change is so sudden and so fast that it's hard to prepare for, because, you know, if anyone works with importing or has any kind of supply chain, they know they can't just be like, okay, well, let's just make it in the United States. It's not so easy. Believe me, we would make a lot more of our stuff in the United States if we could, but there's just not the supply chain available in the United States. So if the idea is to build that up over time, let it build and slowly transition it and support the domestic production of things. But to just say, hey, we're going to cut off and add tariffs of 50% as of next week, it leaves a lot of businesses scrambling on both sides of the border.
I guess part of the problem is I always joke that, you know, somebody operates at the speed of government. Well, with Donald Trump at the, you know, in the Oval Office, government doesn't operate at the speed of government anymore. It operates a lot faster. Mr. Dembski, thanks so much. I appreciate your time. That is Dan Dembski. Dan is CEO at Unbound Merino in the clothing business, as he said, e-commerce. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Got an injury crash.
Not the KXL News Desk with your Tuesday forecast.
Washington, it can.
Have something to say? Give Lars a call at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to take your calls on this Tuesday following Labor Day weekend. My email of the day, and you can send more to talk at LarsLarson.com, is brought to you by Multnomah Medical Clinic. No pills, no shots, no surgery. Fix what's actually causing the problem at Multnomah Medical Clinic. Heather writes in, Lars, so tonight my ex-husband sends me a link. I guess this was last night. Apparently a group of totally normal people who went to the Thorns game, that's the soccer game in Portland, had T-shirts on supporting women's and men's sports. They did. The T-shirts had the logo XX and XY on the T's. They were approached and told to leave because people were uncomfortable. They were told not only to leave the ball game, they were then told to leave a sports bar. These innocent people who went to see a game and then went to a bar were threatened that the authorities were going to be called if they didn't leave because these sissies are scared of a T-shirt. Lars, this is getting really bad. You know what? I had a client today in my design center wearing a Grateful Dead T-shirt. I hate their music, but I'm not going to be threatened by a piece of cotton on somebody's body and call the cops. Could we go back to the 80s when everything was calm and there was no divide, no freak shows, no transgender movements, no LGBT, and then she used the word I can't use on the air, BS. Now indoctrination of our children. Sorry I'm venting tonight. I'm so over the extreme liberal idiots who have their feelings hurt by a GD T-shirt. Thanks for taking the time to read my email. Heather, thank you very much. I appreciate the feedback as well. To your calls now. Let's go to Ted in Gig Harbor. Hey, Ted, thanks for listening on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Question for you, Lars.
Sure.
When Canada ships us, when American companies buy steel or aluminum or other metals from Canada, from a distributor,
yep,
that distributor must certify that that material meets a specification that the buyer gives the distributor, right?
Yeah.
On that certification, it is supposed to disclose the manufacturer of that steel or aluminum or whatever it is. Okay.
Yep.
Now, if that steel, that material is used to make a product here.
Yep.
And that product fails and somebody is injured or killed or there's damage to property, they're going to be discovery. They're going to look at those certifications and they're going to find that wasn't made in Canada. A whole bunch of lawyers are going to make a whole bunch of money off of this one of these days if they know what they're doing.
Maybe.
And
maybe. And the only reason I say maybe is, let's say you were building a house. And you build a house and you ordered up a bunch of 2x6s, because that's mostly what they build houses out of these days. And you order them up and they're supposed to be American origin. But instead, some of them are coming from somewhere else, maybe Canada. And you build the house and then the house is constructed in such a way that the house ends up falling down because it wasn't built right. Yeah, there might be some questioning of where the materials came from, but I have a feeling the vast majority of the blame is going to fall on whoever it was that built the house and not necessarily on where the metal came from. And in fact, even if you could prove this metal came from China instead of coming from Canada, is there any way to sue the Chinese manufacturer of that steel and say this house or this building fell down because it was made of Chinese steel? I think that might be a little bit of a push.
They can sue the Canadians, Lars. They can sue the Canadians.
They could.
The Canadians, though.
Yeah, they could. And I guess what I wonder is, I really wish this was one of those where Trump would communicate a lot more with the American public than he does, because he usually is happy to explain and even over-explain many, many things. Mm-hmm. And I guess it throws me when then there's things like this that do have a real effect on companies in the United States, companies in Canada, and, of course, consumers on both sides, when the president doesn't come out and give us a full explanation, this is what I'm doing, and this is why I'm doing it. And the only thing I can suspect that would make his reticence to explain legitimate is if, by explaining, he'd have to tell us, this is what I'm really aiming for, but I need to push them into a corner first. Which is the case. I mean, Ted, I think of going down on the many occasions that Tina and I over 30 years have, say, bought a car for the family or bought a pickup truck. You don't walk in and tell the dealer, by the way, I am bound and determined to buy a pickup truck tonight, and the high water mark on my price tolerance is $35,000. You don't tell him that walking in the door, or he already owns you. You tell him, yeah, I'm just looking at pickup trucks, and I don't know what I'm going to be ready to spend. You don't give up your advantage by telling what's going on, and that may be where Trump is when it comes to the Canadian tariffs.
Very interesting. Thank you very much.
You bet. It is my pleasure. Thank you very much for the call. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Something I want you to consider. The state of Washington seems to have finally got a bit of common sense when it comes to salvage logging. I'm wondering if Oregon is going to follow suit. I think this is from the Capitol Press. I believe it's the Capitol Press. Washington State Standard did this one, where they pointed out that Washington State is going to increase by a tiny, tiny amount the amount of salvage logging it does. Now, what is salvage logging? When you have state forest land that suffers a fire. The fire usually does not burn all those trees all the way to the ground. They leave damaged trees from which you can salvage an awful lot of lumber. Well, two-thirds of the land that it burned was state forest land. And the Washington State Standard points out that Washington State has now decided to sell a bit more of that salvaged timber, although the loss is absolutely extraordinary. The amount of timber that has burned and then the tiny, tiny fraction of it that is going to be the amount that they will actually go in and salvage, it is embarrassing. They said, for example, 896,000 acres burned. Of those, 93,000 are on state trust land. Two-thirds of that was state forests. That means you could have had those trees cut down, logged, and turned into revenue for the state common school fund. Instead, they're going to go in and do a tiny amount of salvage. I'm just hoping that if they start doing it, the good that we see come out of that money as it flows into the common school fund is going to be repeated by the state of Oregon. I hope they do it as well. By the way, this segment of the show brought to you by NickShivers.com. Ready to be done being a landlord? My Rocket Listing lets you sell your property guaranteed, even with non-paying tenants. Go to NickShivers.com and get the details. That's NickShivers.com, and you've got the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
FM News 10.
In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
Is the Lars Larson Show.
President Trump is one badass president. He secured the border at a level we've never seen before.
Honestly provocative talk with Lars Larson.
For our country and for our children, the best is yet to come.
Broadcasting across the Pacific Northwest and covering Oregon, Washington, and Idaho on the Radio Northwest Network.
Lars.
And now.
He is an existential threat to democracy.
Here's your host.
Quiet, please.
Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you. I hope I'm not telling you a secret when I tell you that the schools in Washington State, and here I'm talking about the public schools K through 12, can keep your child's care a secret from you. Should voters take that power back in November, you're going to get the chance. Glad to have you with me, and always glad to take your calls. And I'm really happy to welcome back Peter Rosenkranz, who is superintendent of the LaCenter School District in Washington State. And I have to say this, even though I've never met Mr. Rosenkranz in person, I think he's one of the few superintendents in the entire Northwest that actually has some common sense when it comes to these kinds of issues. Mr. Rosenkranz, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Lars. I appreciate being back and enjoy the opportunity to talk with you.
Well, I saw your comments when you were testifying in support of Initiative 001, so I-001. Would you mind telling my audience about that and what it means to the students in your schools?
Absolutely. It's fascinating because, again, we're back to the same conversation of whose children are they, and not as a possession, but as a loving family. And if the parents aren't making the decision, who is? And so all it does is restore the language that comes from Initiative 2081, which, by the way, was passed overwhelmingly by our legislature. Complete approval in the Senate and then bipartisan support in the House. So then it was gutted with House Bill 1296, and all this is trying to do is restore that language.
But if they don't restore that language, then the law passed by the legislature and supported by the people is simply not going to be enforced as it was written?
Well, yeah, correct. In other words, it comes down to who has agency over the children. And the state wants the state or the doctor or the mental health therapist to have agency over the children or the children themselves. And we have 18 is an age for, we have that set up as, for a reason. So children are not allowed to do certain things till they're 18, till they're 16.
Right. Yep.
And in this state right now, it's age 13 for medical care. And yet the parents are the ones making the decisions. The parents are ones footing the bill. The parents are the ones that are primary caretakers of their children. Not the state, not the doctor. There's a presumption in Supreme Court law that we presume parents are fit. Because you'll hear the argument that, well, not all parents, some parents abuse children. And unfortunately, that's correct. But we also have procedures and policies in place to help children and help work through that.
You know, I'm going to tell you something, Mr. Rosenkranz. I get a lot of grief from people who say, well, you don't like teachers. I said, I don't have a problem with teachers. I have a problem with the way the entire system fails the kids. But when I hear teachers and people in education say, well, you know, some parents aren't fit, you know, I've gotten to the point where I'm going to start responding by saying, you know, some teachers are not fit. Some teachers are pedophiles. Some teachers are child rapists. I mean, and you know, you and I both know that's true. And, I mean, it's almost once a week we see some kind of case, usually here in the Northwest, where a teacher is identified as downloading child porn or taking advantage of kids or even committing crimes against children. But we don't say, well, because some teachers are identified as unfit, then therefore we assume they all are. But a lot of the people in the educational field seem to want to make that assumption about parents because some parents are unfit.
Well, and it's not just education. Our government does the same thing. And I believe we talked about this before, but we had an experiment over 100 years ago with tribal schools where the state assumed to know more than the parents of Native children and took them away from Native parents. And how did that work out?
Not so well.
No. The Supreme Court has time and time again and just reaffirmed that parents are the caretakers of their children not wards of the state with Mirabelli de Bonta case out of California.
And yet, you know, just today, one of the things that kind of gets under my skin, Ms. Rosenkrantz, Seattle schools just announced, we're going to provide all breakfasts and all lunches for children. And I thought, I understand if you say we're going to do it for the kids, you know, from families that are desperately poor. But the minute you start doing it for every kid, especially in a prosperous place like Seattle, you're effectively telling the parents, it's not your job to feed the kids. We'll take care of it. And you're telling the kids the same message. And I think both of those are terribly damaging messages. Just tell the kids your real mommy and daddy is government. You know, your parents, yeah. They live in the house where you go to sleep every night, but they're really not in charge of you. It's the government that's in charge of you. I think that's it's perverse as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, it is interesting. They spend with us, with education systems, and there are amazing teachers out there, and there are amazing administrators and systems.
True.
But it just seems more and more this idea that we are called to keep secrets from kids, and I refuse to keep secrets, or excuse me, keep secrets from parents.
Yes.
And I refuse to keep secrets from parents. So it's their children. They need all that information to raise them. But if you do the math, we actually, in a school year, see kids of all the hours in a year, in a calendar year, we see them 13% of the time. They're in their parents' care 87% of the time.
Yep.
And again, that you do that math, it's amazing we can do what we do in the short amount of time in a calendar year. But at the same time, we need to partner with parents. If that kiddo is struggling with reading, we need to talk with the parents about that. If the kiddo is struggling with their identity, we also need to talk with the parents about that, because there very well could be something underneath that that the parents would either know about or need to know about so they can support.
Well, I got to tell you something. I want to see parents more involved with their kids, and I want to see the schools try to stop cutting them out. And I'd also like to see... I ask school board members to come on this show all the time. I very rarely get somebody who's willing to come on, but it's impossible for me to imagine a school board member coming on this show and then with a straight face saying, no, parents have no business knowing that their child is having severe difficulties that have to do with their identity, with their sexuality, and that we should keep those parents in the dark. It stuns me that there are actually adults out there who claim that is the way that they're looking at these things. It doesn't make any sense at all. Mr. Rosenkrantz, we appreciate you coming on. That is Peter Rosenkrantz. He is the superintendent of the Le Centre School District, and he's a big supporter of Initiative I-001. I encourage you to vote in favor of I-001. When I cast my ballot, I'll be voting yes on Initiative 001, because I want parents to have the information about their kids, and I don't think the schools have any business holding that back. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
Seeing some delays both the
at the KXL News Desk with your Tuesday forecast.
Reading glasses.
Disagree with Lars? Great. Naysayers go first at 866-HEY-LARS. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails in just a moment. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And as always, naysayers go to the head of the line. So if you hear something you disagree with, I'm glad to have you call and make your point and, you know, raise whatever objection you want to raise to the argument I made. I would imagine we're going to hear some naysayers on this one. One state in America has now spent a record amount on public schools. Did the school funding increase make the kids better readers or worse? I don't think you're going to be surprised, but then again, I've given you a hint or two of what's going on. If you want to join that conversation, you're certainly welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our poll on X. We put up a brand new public opinion poll. You can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Today's question, should New Mexico be renamed New America? Donald Trump, I think he may have been joking when he showed all of these memes that were AI-generated, artificial intelligence-generated, saying that New Mexico should be renamed New America. And there was another one in which he said, the moon is ours. I have a feeling he's, for the most part, trying to troll some of the nitwits in the mainstream media. But you can find the question at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. Let me get back to what Michigan has done, because that is the state that has spent a record amount of money on public schools. And guess what? Things did not get better. They actually got worse. And that's saying something, because Michigan is one of the 50 states, 58 if you're an Obama voter, but 50 for the rest of us. And the United States of America now spends more money than every other country on earth per student per year. It's right around $18,000 to $20,000 for every student per year. Now, some of the states spend a bit less, some spend a bit more. But in Michigan, run by Governor Gretchen Whitmer and others, they have just gone to town when it comes to public funding. Listen to this. Recently released test results show new lows for Michigan students on standardized exams, even as the state continues to spend historic amounts of money on education. So they're spending record amounts on K-12. They're achieving worse results every year. State Superintendent Dr. Glenn Malienko says that more work is needed, especially on reading. That's what they always say. He says it'll take continued hard work from everybody and a strong students-first approach to improve student achievement. You know this Malienko character? He ought to come out to the public and simply say, you're right. The numbers this year are worse than the numbers last year. Clearly, what we're doing is not getting the problem solved. Instead, he merely says, well, if we work really, really hard at it, yeah, if you continue working this hard, you might get the kids down to zero. He says that means we must emphasize teamwork involving the State Board of Education, local school districts, parents, the governor, the legislature, and the business community, education associations, labor, higher ed, and libraries. Sounds like a true Democrat to me. Results of the 2026 Michigan Student Test of Educational Progress, known as the M-STEP, found that 61.8% of all third graders scored below proficient. That's almost two-thirds of the students were below proficient on the state's English language arts test. That was up slightly from 61.1. It's an ongoing trend over the last few years. Fourth graders saw a similar increase this year in the percentage of students scoring below proficient. In the exam's 12-year history, the 2026 results are the worst scores ever recorded among third graders. And yet, Michigan has increased the amount of money it's spending on education. The Michigan Department of Ed said in a press release on the report, the results were largely unchanged from 2025. Generally true, but when something gets worse by 0.75 percentage point, even if it's that small, if it's moving the wrong direction, you shouldn't say, mostly unchanged. Why don't you tell the truth and say we're actually doing worse than we were last year? They said in a press release, most proficiency rates were essentially flat compared to 2025, with rates on all four of the 20 tests staying within 2 percentage points of the numbers in 2025. Now, they were able to blame COVID a couple of years ago. They said current third graders were 2 or 3 years old when the pandemic began in 2020. Gretchen Whitmer had mistaken priorities when it came to education from day one. Adults had failed our kids, plain and simple. From the State Board of Ed to administrators and our governor, the students have been left behind while they choose to prioritize their own agendas. Whitmer's administration has been one failure after another, and now she is dragging her feet. between grades 3 and 7, an average of less than 40% of students were found by MSTEP to be advanced or proficient in English language arts. That's compared to an average of 47% 10 years ago. So they've actually moved the marker down by almost 10 points in the last 10 years. In recent years, the state legislature has increased per pupil funding to try to fix this. In this budget cycle, the budget increased the state's allowance by $250 per student. That brings total funding at the state level to $10,300. Now, let me tell you something. That number only tells part of the story. If you add up all of the spending that is done by states like Michigan, it comes out a lot higher than $10,000. And one of the reasons they try to hide some of those numbers is they're well aware that parents are going to say, for that kind of money, I could have put my kid in a private school, and instead you have him being taught by a bunch of unionized teachers. And why? Well, in the state of Michigan, like a lot of Democrat-dominated states, it's because the teachers' union gives lots and lots of money to the Democrat cause. And that is really what it comes down to. Your kids can have a terrible education, but as long as the Democrat politicians get the money they need to run for re-election, the state doesn't really care. All they do is they say, we're going to shovel more money at the problem, even when more money has not fixed it, not one little bit. Back in a moment. Glad to get your calls. 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest with honestly provocative...
The Lars Larson Show.
Portland's Lars reads every email. No, really. Talk@LarsLarson.com. That's talk@LarsLarson.com. Now, back to the Lars Larson Show.
Hey, welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. Well, your health insurance keeps on getting more expensive, and you've been hearing a lot about that lately, about how much health insurance premiums are expected to go up. But are the companies raising your rates and making a lot more money than they're telling you while you're paying the larger bill? Mark Merritt joins me now, who's executive director at the Insurance Watchdog Coalition. Mark, welcome to the program.
Thanks. Good to be here, Lars.
So are health insurers getting rich while the rest of us get stuck with the bill?
Well, yeah. I mean, we're paying more on average now for health insurance premiums than home mortgages, and that's a big problem. And you might be able to say, well, there's if people were getting far better care or more care for their dollar, that might be an argument you could try to make, but the reality is the care is going down, the costs are going up, and the insurance companies are making out like bandits. Their profits are huge. Their profits are three times what the drug companies make, that everybody always talks about the drug companies making a lot of money. Well, the health insurance companies have 33% profit margin, which is just absolutely phenomenal. And they say they make about 3% profit. It's more than 10 times that. It's out of control and something we need reform now.
Well, let me ask you about those numbers, because when I hear 33% gross profit, but then 7.6% net margin, can you help straighten that out for folks out here who are not economists, nor are we, you know, we're not CPAs or anything like that? Help me understand, because when I see, if I say, well, you're making 7.5%, that doesn't sound like a gigantic net profit, does it?
No, it doesn't, but it's the way that they account it, and this is where we get a little bit wonky, but you know what insurance companies do is they collect premiums, and the health insurance companies pass those right through to doctors and hospitals. You know, a lot of that money is just a pass-through money, but they're counting that different. In other words, with a life insurance company versus a health insurance company, when they get a premium, they're investing the money, and the money goes somewhere, and then you get the money back at some point, or a big portion of it.
Right.
It's much different with health insurance companies. It's going straight to the hospitals, but it's treated as though it's regular revenue, which sounds like a wonky little thing, but it's actually huge and really hides a lot of their profits.
It hides their profits, but if they're passing the money through straight from the premium to the healthcare institution, then is the insurance company getting a cut of that, or are they just passing it all through, and the health insurance institutions or the people within them, the doctors and such, are the ones actually making the big profit?
Well, let's take a look at who they're passing that money through. A lot of it is passed through to companies that they own. And so now the UnitedHealthcare employs more doctors than anybody in America.
Yep.
So when they say they're paying doctors more, it's their own doctors. When they say they're paying pharmacies more, it's their own pharmacies. It's their own specialty pharmacies for these very expensive high-tech drugs. So that money is going somewhere, but it's going essentially to themselves. UnitedHealthcare has like 3,000 subsidiaries. And so it is a network of companies that is mutually profitable. And it would be different if the money was just going out the door to other companies, but a huge margin of that is going right to themselves in the form of subsidiaries that they own.
I'm talking to Mark Merritt, who's the executive director of the Insurance Watchdog Coalition. So what's the best way to sort this out? And please don't tell me it's Medicare for all, because I hate that idea.
No, it's not Medicare for all.
Thank you.
I think you need some basic patient protections. And I'm not talking about government intervention, government control, but basic things like hospital health insurers should report things like how many claims do they deny, to how many claims is there thing, are there things like prior authorizations, the things that keep people get from getting the health care they need.
Right.
How much of the money is going, how much more are they charging or paying to themselves versus other doctors, other health companies that they don't own? Because that's been a big problem, is they pay themselves more. And then they charge that back to the federal government for big programs like Medicare. So you have the federal government paying more to these insurance companies and their subsidiaries. And it's kind of it's a vicious cycle. And so I think some basic transparency reforms where you can see where the money's going, where you can see what kind of care you're getting, and you can see whether your claims are going to be rejected or accepted when you choose one insurer over the other. Interjecting more competition and letting people see the difference between these insurers and making them compete, not just on money, not just on premiums, but also on the kind of care that they deliver, so people are actually getting care for the dollar that they spend.
I guess what I wonder is, because I don't have a dog in the fight, I don't own insurance stocks, I don't have any friends who work at the insurance companies, you know, and I have to deal with them too. I've got to buy insurance just like anybody else does, except my employer usually buys the health insurance, and I don't have to negotiate for it. But if you tell me they're rejecting certain people and saying no, well, shouldn't they be in some cases? Because if somebody says, hey, I'd like this procedure done, and you look at it and say, that procedure is not warranted for what you have, who's the best person to decide that? Somebody at the insurance company or your doctor? And if your doctor says you need it or you ought to get it, is he always right? Because I also hear about doctors who, you know, will say, we ought to do this for you. And you say, that's a bit of overkill. We don't need that. Maybe we need something else. How do we decide who's right in that case?
Well, it's a tug of war, and it kind of should be that way, where they have to, where the payer, the insurer, preemptive, and the doctor have to make their case. The challenge right now is it's just no competition. For one thing, the doctors, many of them are actually owned by UnitedHealthcare. They're employees of UnitedHealthcare. So the insurer is calling the shots completely in those cases. But even when they're dealing with independent doctors or hospitals, UnitedHealthcare has 400,000 employees, and most of them are bean counters, expert money people. And you just can't compete with that if you're just some local hospital or some local set of doctors. And so in the old days, like I used to be an insurance executive for the health insurance industry. And back then, there was a healthy tension where, you know, people could complain about what I did in the insurance industry by saying, well, you know what, they save money, but also, you know what, you might not get all the care you need. That was kind of a fair deal. Now what's happening is you're not saving money, you're spending more money and you're getting less care. And it's only getting more like that, where people are spending more and more and finding out when they go to get their benefits, the copay is too high, they can't afford the premium, the doctor's not in the network, the drug isn't on the formulary. And it's a point of balance where there just needs to be a better point of balance between hospitals and doctors and insurance companies. And right now it's a one-sided fight.
I couldn't agree with you more. Hey, Mark, tell my audience where they can find info from the Insurance Watchdog Coalition.
InsuranceWatchdogCoalition.com. It's that simple. And there's a lot of good information there, and it's a relatively new organization, but there's more to come. InsuranceWatchdogCoalition.com.
Very good. That's Mark Merritt from the InsuranceWatchdogCoalition.com. Back in a moment. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network. Now you might find yourself.
Missed the Lars Larson Show? Get the podcast right now at LarsLarson.com. Now, more with Lars Larson.
Hey, welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get to your phone calls and emails at 866-HEY-LARS. You know, Republican Congressman Michael Baumgartner says that Washington lawmakers should pitch Evergreen State College as the home of Donald Trump's new U.S. Space Academy. Apparently, they're going to have a space academy, same as they have a United States Naval Academy, the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs, and, of course, West Point for the United States Army. Now a U.S. Space Academy, great. Straighten out all the problems at Evergreen State College by turning that over to Space Force. I think that's a terrific idea from Congressman Michael Baumgartner. Glad to get your calls. If you want to join what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk at LarsLarson.com. And I got a bunch of emails that are just begging to be shared with you. Number one, Rick just wrote in, having heard the discussion about insurance companies making all that money. He says, so if the insurance companies are making all kinds of money, why is Providence quitting the insurance business? We have Providence Medicare Advantage Plus, and it's going away at the end of the year. We are being left in the lurch. And I think the short answer is, some folks in the insurance business are making bank, and some folks are not. And then this, when we mention illegal aliens becoming police officers in some towns in America, one of them in Connecticut in particular, Danbury, Connecticut, is now going to allow non-citizens, including DACAs. DACAs are not just non-citizens. They are illegal aliens whose status was put into a kind of limbo by Barack Hussein Obama, tested by the courts under Donald Trump and found to be illegal, but they are still in the United States. And James writes in, Lars, I would assume that to be a police officer, you probably have to do a federal background check. Hopefully the Trump administration would be smart enough to automatically flag the illegal aliens when they're getting a background check. And I'll bet they have to state the reason for the background check. Food for thought that some lawyer could probably answer that one. And then this from Dean, who says, we've been talking about the interstate bridge replacement today and the fact that the IBR, according to Bob Ortblad, who's a civil engineer, he's looked at the design, he submitted it to AI, to artificial intelligence, because IBR will not do a study to find out what the maximum safe speed is for the new bridge. Because part of the plan is, and again, this gets a little complicated, right now the bridge has two spans. It was originally one bridge about 100 years ago, and then they built a second bridge, and they made one of them the northbound span, and one of them is the southbound span. Well, in similar way, they plan to build a brand new southbound span for the bridge. And once that's built, even though it's only 76 feet wide, they're going to cram all six lanes, both north and south, onto the brand newest span of the bridge. Then they will tear the old bridge down altogether and then rebuild a northbound span for the bridge. But that's going to take close to 4 years. So what Bob Ortblad wanted to find out was, well, what will be the safe speed for vehicles on a bridge that is that crowded and has an S-curve built into it? You know what the short answer is? The safe speed for cars will be 30 miles an hour. The safe speed for trucks will be 20 miles an hour, and that's assuming dry conditions and no wind. If you add in a certain amount of wind, and a certain amount of either rain or snow or ice or other slick stuff, then the safe speed could go down to trucks aren't allowed to use the bridge at all on days like that, and cars will only be allowed to go 5 to 10 miles an hour. So, and that's going to go on for about 4 years until the new northbound span is built. And as Ortblad says, there's no guarantee that it's going to improve dramatically after that, because the amount of traffic that's going to be on that bridge is going to keep it clogged up very, very much. But I get this email from Dean, who says, Lars, the best way to complete the replacement of the Interstate 5 bridge is build a brand new bridge identical to the 205 bridge between Washington State Highway 14 and Interstate 84, somewhere between Troutdale and Gresham. We need more bridges between Oregon and Washington to facilitate increased traffic. Only the morons in charge of Oregon and DOT and Washington DOT are too stupid to think of that. Keep up the great work. I've listened to your show for 27 years. Dean, I've got to respectfully tell you why the idea you have to build a brand new bridge out toward the east end of Interstate 84 to connect to Highway 14 in Washington State. Let me tell you why it won't work. Number one, you still have to have a bridge that carries I-5 traffic that goes across Hayden Island and into downtown Portland. And if you build a bridge far out to the east, you already have 205, you go farther out to the east. Number one, you're not connecting the high density parts of Clark County to the high density parts of Oregon. But even if you assume that part of it will work, and it is one of the wider parts of the Columbia River right there, so you'd be building a bridge that's much, much longer than the 205 bridge. And when you connect it, you'll be connecting it from one already undersized highway, Highway 14, to Interstate 84, which is already very, very jammed up and congested as it is. It would also mean that where you say, we're going to have people go from parts of Vancouver, they will travel east about 15 miles to get to the new bridge, then they'll travel across the bridge to Oregon and have to travel 15 miles back in, assuming that they're going either to downtown Portland or to somewhere on the west side of Washington County or the west side of Multnomah County. None of that makes sense. It doesn't make sense to do that, and you still have to deal with the bridge you've got over the Columbia River at Interstate 5. So if you want to change to that kind of bridge, the reason nobody's talking about it is it does not make sense to build a bridge that far to the east. There's just not the road to connect it to. Anytime you're building a bridge, you've got to think, what am I connecting it from, in this case, Highway 14, and what am I connecting it to, Interstate 84, that is already heavily congested. And adding all that heavy traffic there is not going to do anybody any good, and I think it would be a big nightmare when it comes to traffic congestion. But instead, we're going to get this crazy IBR project that isn't going to help anybody either, and you might have trucks running at 10 miles an hour. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show and the Radio Northwest Network, serving the Pacific Northwest states, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, with honestly provocative talk.
The Lars Larson Show.
Hey there,
FM News 101.